Hello and welcome back to The Fall of the Roman Empire. My name is Nick Holmes and this is episode 31 called The Battle of Strasbourg. In the last episode, we left Julian, Constantius's newly appointed Caesar in Gaul, facing a massive German army as it advanced towards Strasbourg on the Roman-German frontier. You'll recall that Julian had already distinguished himself as a capable general, leading his small detachment of soldiers to victory in various skirmishes with the Germans, as well as fighting for control of some of the main towns still standing in eastern Gaul, such as Cologne, which he recovered from the Franks in 356. As a consequence, Constantius had made him commander-in-chief in Gaul, so he now had a fair-sized army under his control. But his counterpart in Italy, Barbatio, had just been defeated by the Germans as he tried to advance through Switzerland in a pincer movement against the Germans. This now left Julian to meet the Germans alone in what would be his first major battle. Now, we have exceptionally good surviving records of the Battle of Strasbourg, or Argentoratum, as the Romans called it. Ammianus Marcellinus has left us a very detailed account, and we also have a useful account by the 5th century Roman writer Zosimus, as well, of course, as Julian's own writings about it, although perhaps surprisingly, these are relatively brief and modest. So, the story goes that the German army crossed the Rhine in late August 357, near to the Roman fortified town of Strasbourg, using a Roman bridge that had not been destroyed. What made the German army so large was that it was a united force of Alemanni who were still fragmented into tribal groupings. It was led by a fiery character called Chondomar, nicknamed Gigas the Giant by the Romans because he was particularly tall and strong. With him were six other kings and princes, and a total army of about 35,000, according to Ammianus. Meanwhile, Julian's army had 13,000 men, again according to Ammianus, although some historians have suggested it might have been a bit larger, around 15,000 to 20,000. Whatever the truth, it was certainly heavily outnumbered, but nevertheless, the Romans were exceptionally high-quality troops. There was a large cavalry contingent, maybe up to 3,000 strong, comprising mailed horsemen and mounted archers, who, as you may recall from episodes 14 and 15, were the battle-winning innovation of the Illyrian emperors that saved Rome in the 3rd century. These were the tanks of the new Roman army, and Julian hoped to use them to rout the Germans, who had only a few and relatively lightly armed cavalry. But the bulk of the army was infantry, and included some of the best regiments in the entire Roman army. There were 5,000 or so legionaries, including some famous legions, and worth noting that a legion in the late Roman Empire was typically only about 1,000 men, so much smaller than the 5,000 strong legions of the earlier empire. And these famous legions were the Herculiani, the Joviani, and the Primani. These were all legions set up by the Illyrian emperors in the 3rd century. And they worked together with some very highly regarded auxiliary units, mainly recruited from the German tribes themselves, but who were trained and disciplined after Roman methods. And these included the Cornuti and the Brachiati, who were famously long-standing veteran soldiers. The Cornuti are even displayed on the Arch of Constantine as one of his key regiments in the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. Against this elite Roman force, the Germans were a very different type of army. They were almost entirely infantry, organised into their tribal groupings, so their discipline and coordination was greatly inferior to that of the Romans. But despite this, like the Franks and Burgundians, the Alemanni were a highly militarised society with great emphasis placed on their warriors' bravery and skill in battle, so they were still a very formidable enemy. One important difference compared with the Romans that's particularly worth noting was the German use of cavalry. Being lightly armed, they really could not match the Romans in hand-to-hand combat, but they were still capable of playing a few tricks, as Ammianus described. Quote, "They, the Germans, realised that one of their warriors on horseback, no matter how skillful, in meeting one of our clibinarii," that was the term used to describe the particularly heavily armoured Roman cavalry, "must hold bridle and shield in one hand and brandish his spear in the other, and would thus be able to do no harm to a Roman soldier protected by metal armour, whereas the infantry soldier, in the hottest part of the fight, when nothing is apt to be guarded against except what is straight ahead of oneself, can move around low down and unseen, and by piercing a horse's side, throw its unsuspecting rider headlong, whereupon he can be slain with little trouble." End quote. And as you will soon hear, this tactic was to be used to devastating effect in the battle. So the first question for Julian to decide was whether to retreat or give battle. He seems to have had little doubt that the latter course of action was the best. He'd learnt from Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars that attack was often the best form of defence. He'd also commanded the Roman army in Gaul for a good 1.5 years and had acquired an excellent rapport with his officers and men. In addition, he knew that the troops he commanded were exceptionally high quality, to be honest, probably just as good as Caesar's legions had been nearly 400 years before. So, in late August 357, Julian advanced rapidly to meet the Germans outside Strasbourg, where most of them had by now crossed the Rhine. The Romans sighted the Germans around midday. Julian deployed the army in a textbook Roman formation with the heavy cavalry on the right wing. He took personal command of the infantry in the centre, while his experienced general Severus, commanding the left wing, with a mix of infantry and cavalry. Meanwhile, the Germans had prepared themselves well. Both sides used scouts and had acquired a reasonable knowledge of the other's battle formation. Chondomar positioned himself opposite the Roman heavy cavalry, expecting their attack to be the main Roman assault. He took what cavalry the Germans had. The great bulk of the German army, as I mentioned, was infantry, which took up a position facing the Roman legionaries in the centre. On the German right wing, a king called Serapion hid in a large wood with thousands of infantry and cavalry waiting to ambush Severus. However, just before the battle began, an incident occurred which provides a fascinating insight into the mentality of the German warriors. For they suddenly clamoured for their leaders to dismount from their horses and fight on foot. Their intention was to deny them an easy escape route in the event the Romans started to win the battle. Chondomar and the other kings obliged. This suggests that Germanic society was surprisingly egalitarian at this time. In contrast, it would have been unthinkable for the Romans to demand the same from their commanders. The Roman military structure was, of course, intensely hierarchical and firmly based on rank and discipline, and as such, went back to the days of the Republic when it was so admired by the Greek historian Polybius, as described in the histories over 500 years before, which we discussed fully back in episode 2. What the German behaviour, however, does suggest was a lack of discipline. And as we will find out, this was to prove decisive in the forthcoming battle. So, shortly after the German leaders dismounted, the Roman trumpets heralded the attack. The Roman legionaries in the centre advanced in a tight formation, while the Germans rushed to meet them, roaring their battle cry. Ammianus has described the terrifying spectacle of the German charge. Quote, they gnashed their teeth hideously and raged beyond their usual manner. Their flowing hair made a terrible sight, and a kind of madness shone from their eyes. End quote. There was an exchange of javelins, and then the Romans formed a tight shield wall in a sort of semi-testudo or tortoise formation, with the ranks behind the front line holding their shields high over their heads to protect them from the downpour of arrows and javelins. The tortoise formation was, of course, one of the most famous tactics of the Roman army, especially in the early empire, and it's interesting to note that Ammianus says it still existed in the late Roman army. While the Roman centre stood firm, the left wing, led by Severus, made some progress, despite being ambushed by the Germans hiding in the wood. But it was on the right wing that disaster struck the Romans, for their heavy cavalry, which Julian had placed there and which he hoped would deliver the knockout blow against the Germans, found themselves embroiled in a desperate fight in which some of the German horsemen, as noted earlier, dismounted and infiltrated the Roman cavalry, stabbing their horses from below and then butchering their unseated riders. In their heavy armour, the Romans found it difficult to fend off the German infantry, and when they saw a tribune wounded in this way and another particularly heavily armoured horseman, Acribinarius, thrown by his horse and badly injured by his heavy armour, they decided their armour was not going to help them, so they turned and fled. Julian, who was in the centre, and as Ammianus described him, quote, who did not know the meaning of fear, end quote, spurred his horse towards them to restore order. Standing with his bodyguard and highly visible because of the purple dragon standard held aloft by a long spear, he met the retreating horsemen and halted their retreat. Or at least that's Ammianus's version, for Zosimus's account, although written many years later, says that Julian could not prevent the cavalry from retreating off the field. I think this is probably more likely, since we know the Roman infantry in the centre were now exposed to the full fury of the German attack from both their left wing, which had routed the Roman horsemen, and also the German centre. It really looked as if the Germans were going to win the battle. But then two things happened. First, Severus on the left wing held firm and started to push back the German right wing, so at least the legionaries in the centre didn't need to worry about their left flank. Second, and this seems to have been the most decisive factor of all, was the bringing up of elite infantry reserves, which Julian had held back. These were the veteran Cornuti and Brachiati auxiliary units, which, as I mentioned earlier, although they probably consisted of Germanic recruits themselves, were exceptionally well-disciplined and integrated into the Roman army, and they proved quite capable at stemming the German onslaught. Now, this was where Julian's leadership probably made the difference, because holding a good reserve of high-quality troops was another tactical trick that he'd picked up from reading Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, and in the Battle of Strasbourg, it proved decisive. For, despite the Roman cavalry being routed, the Germans were held back along the entire Roman line by a thick wall of shields and testudo formations. Only once did the Germans break through, and they were immediately confronted by the heavy legionaries of the Legio Primani, the Praetorians of the Roman army, as Ammianus described them. These soldiers, quote, stood as firm as towers and renewed the battle with increased spirit, end quote, according to Ammianus. This proved decisive. The attacking Germans were pushed back, and with corpses piling up in front of the Roman shields, their morale broke. The lack of discipline among the Germans meant that the ferocity of their attack was immediately replaced by panic. Suddenly, groups of warriors started to flee. Then the entire German army broke up and swarmed back towards the Rhine. The Romans ran after them, killing them in their thousands. However, Julian, who was always famously in the midst of the battle, showing no fear for himself, was afraid of a German counterattack, as Julius Caesar warned so often followed a retreat by the enemy. So he quickly ordered trumpets and bugles to call the Romans to a halt and pursue the Germans in an ordered fashion to the bank of the Rhine, where the Roman archers could pick them off as they struggled to swim across, providing a stage show, as Ammianus described it, in which the Romans watched the barbarians drowning, swimming, and being transfixed by Roman arrows and javelins. It was a complete victory for the Romans. The German king Gondomar was captured. Ammianus claims that 6,000 German corpses were counted on the battlefield, aside from the thousands that died in the rout and their desperate crossing over the Rhine. The number of Roman dead, according to Ammianus, was only 243 men and 4 officers, which does seem unrealistically low. The battle is particularly revealing about the condition of the late Roman army, since it showed that late Roman soldiers had retained many of the characteristics that had enabled them to achieve success in the golden age of the Republic and early Empire. Most importantly, the army's legendary discipline was shown to be as strong as ever, even when its ethnic composition was predominantly Gallic for the legionaries and Germanic for the auxiliaries. But before we get carried away with praise for the army, it is worth noting the poor performance of the heavy cavalry, which had won so many battles under Aurelian, Diocletian, and Constantine in the 3rd century. Indeed, after the battle, Julian punished the heavy cavalry by making them put on women's clothing and do a sort of parade of shame while the infantry jeered them. This reflects less well on the Roman army's abilities and suggests that the cavalry, which had been an important new offensive capability developed by the Illyrian emperors, had lost its cutting edge. And given that the Battle of Strasbourg was really the last great Roman victory in the late empire, that is at least until the advent of Justinian's and Belisarius's reconquest of the Western Empire in the much later 6th century, it has to be said that the failure of Julian's cavalry to perform at Strasbourg should be noted as an ominous sign that despite the great victory, the Roman army had passed its peak. Nevertheless, the battle was a clear game changer in 4th century Roman history in 3 important ways. First, it saved Gaul from a serious Germanic invasion and secured the western frontier. Second, it caused a rift between Julian and Constantius, as the latter could not ignore Julian's growing popularity. Third, since Gaul was now safe, it offered the possibility to redeploy the Gallic troops in due course to focus on the Sassanian front. Let's look at the first of these. In the months after the battle, true to his tireless character, Julian consolidated the opportunities afforded by the victory. He crossed the Rhine and ravaged Alemanni territory in punishment for their daring to invade Gaul. He also concentrated his now weary army on ridding northern Gaul of a Frankish presence which had developed during the years of neglect when Magnentius had revolted. Basing his forces in Cologne, he and Severus conducted numerous expeditions to recover territory from the Franks in what is now northern France, and then conducted a punitive campaign against another similar German tribe called the Chamavi, who had occupied what is now the modern Netherlands and used their command of the rivers Rhine, Meuse, and the Scheldt waterways to cut off the grain supply from Britain. This supply had become particularly important for the Roman army in Gaul, really because of the Frankish devastation of the countryside in northern Gaul, which had also probably never fully recovered from the earlier destruction wrought in the crisis of the 3rd century. Meanwhile, all the time that Julian was consolidating and building his reputation in Gaul, Constantius was not surprisingly becoming more and more suspicious of his young cousin. Indeed, it's perhaps surprising that his paranoia was not aroused earlier than it appears to have been by Julian's successes. But this was largely because Julian was extremely sensitive to the issue, and despite even being applauded as Augustus by his troops immediately after his victory at Strasbourg, he concealed this from Constantius and continued to send him lengthy panegyrics in which he praised the middle-aged emperor for his courage and sagacity. But Constantius was alert to Julian's growing threat to his authority, and true to form, he began a cunning strategy to undermine his new Caesar. For example, the army and the administration of Gaul were kept as separate organisations, as Diocletian had originally devised to prevent corruption. And Constantius tried to turn this to Julian's disadvantage by appointing his own administrative minister, Florentius, to hinder Julian in every way he could, even depriving his troops of pay on the basis that tax revenues had fallen sharply in Gaul. Constantius also managed to recall Julian's trusted second-in-command, Salutius Secundus, who was doubly important to him after the death of Severus, his able lieutenant who'd helped him to victory at Strasbourg but died of natural causes soon afterwards. Then, in January 360, Constantius ordered Julian to send his best troops to fight a growing Persian war in the east. He ordered his four best regiments to leave Gaul immediately. This probably represented just under half of Julian's army and would have left his military strength severely depleted. Now, to be totally fair to Constantius, this was justified since Shapur II had just launched another Persian offensive and succeeded in taking the major Syrian fortress of Emida. But it was also very convenient for Constantius since it would mean stripping Julian of his military power in the west. Now, what would Julian do? He had to make the greatest decision of his life. Would he give in to Constantius? Or would it be civil war? And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, of course, I'd be delighted for any ratings or reviews in whichever podcast app you use. And in the next episode, we'll continue with the extraordinary story of Julian the Apostate. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.